Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today we are honored to have with us Jerome F. Buting, author of Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer, and America's Broken System. This is the saga not only of the accused Stephen Avery, but also what in Mr. Buting's mind is wrong with America's criminal justice system. Welcome, Jerry. Jerry, are you there? Well, I see him on the line, but hopefully he will call back again. We seem to be having some technological problems. But for those of our listeners who a couple of years ago watched Netflix series Making of a Murderer, you understood or you saw firsthand just how broken America's criminal justice system was. You may remember that Stephen Avery, many years before, had been convicted of a crime, and then he had been exonerated. And the state of Wisconsin and local authorities were held liable in a civil suit and required to pay a significant amount of damages. Fast forward, there was a murder in Wisconsin, and Mr. Avery was quickly under suspicion for that particular and was arrested by authorities and put on trial along with his nephew, Brendan Dassey. Jerry, are you on the line again?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, loudly and clearly. Apologies for the technological difficulties. I was telling our audience a little bit about Stephen Avery and giving them the background of his second trial. Can you pick up from there and in 2 minutes or less, and I know this is an impossible request, tell our audience a bit about that second trial and how you became involved in Mr. Avery's defense.
Sure. He was charged with the murder of Teresa Halbach shortly after, or really right in the midst of this lawsuit that he had filed against Manitowoc County for his first wrongful conviction. And, of course, when he got charged, it was huge publicity all over the state because he was at that time, and thankfully still is, the only DNA exoneree to ever be charged with and later convicted of a serious charge like homicide. He initially had public defenders appointed for him, and then he had a $36 million lawsuit pending against the county for the first wrongful conviction. That settled for a pittance because after he gets charged with murder, the value of that case went way down. That settled for about $400,000. They then paid his attorney's fees out of that, and then the balance was used to hire private attorneys, including Dean Strang and myself, and that was about 3.5 to 4 months after he had been charged. So the case was already going, significantly before we got on the case and then stayed on it for the trial.
Now, I have a question that's probably on the mind of many of our listeners. Do you think that Mr. Avery became an automatic suspect because of the lawsuit he had filed against the county? In other words, once in law enforcement's Rolodex, always in law enforcement's Rolodex?
Well, not necessarily. I wouldn't go so far as to say that would be true of all law enforcement, but in this particular case, yes, he became the suspect from the very beginning. There was animosity between him and the local sheriff before his first wrongful conviction, and then after he's brings the lawsuit against them, not only are they, at risk of large multi-million dollar lawsuit, but they were embarrassed. And
sure.
He was embarrassing them big time. And so when we got the discovery in the case, it was obvious from day one, very beginning when she was still just a missing person, that they were focusing exclusively on Stephen Avery as the primary suspect, even to the extent of, in really all over the world, when a woman is found murdered, about 90-some% of the time, the killer comes from her circle of acquaintances, whether it's a husband, ex-husband, boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, colleague at work, or something of that nature. 90% of the time. And yet, the people that fit within that circle for Teresa Halbach were never considered suspects in this investigation. And, you know, they didn't have alibis either asked about at all for the day that she went missing, or they were never checked up. The focus was exclusively on Stephen Avery, even though he was not the only person who had access to her. And he certainly had no motive to have killed her, unlike others who were within her circle of friends who might have, or circle of acquaintances, I said, who might have had more of the traditional kind of motive you see in most homicide of women.
Interesting. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to criminal defense lawyer Jerome F. Buting. He is the author of a recently published book by HarperCollins titled Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. Jerry, a few minutes ago, I mentioned Mr. Avery's co-defendant, Brendan Dassey. Briefly, tell us who Brendan Dassey was and how he got wrapped up in this whole case.
Well, Brendan, at the time, was Stephen Avery's 16-year-old nephew. He was in high school. He has learning disabilities, and he was a partial alibi for Stephen Avery on the day that she disappeared. So they targeted him, I believe, that is, law enforcement targeted him to not only get rid of a possible defense alibi witness for Stephen Avery, but also to try and flip him into, you know, confessing and implicating his uncle, Stephen Avery. And so what they did was they used these, they took him out of school. He's brought down to the police station, and then they subject him to these very coercive, psychologically coercive interrogation techniques, which unfortunately are the norm in America. And only in America.
Now, if I can interrupt you, did he have a parent or some other adult with him at the time of the interrogation?
He did not. And, you know, under the law, it wasn't required in Wisconsin, still isn't in Wisconsin. A few states have changed the law, and actually Seattle as well, since Making a Murderer came out. But So he's subjected as this 16-year-old with mental limitations to these very skilled interrogators who then proceed to feed him facts and get him to, you know, twist his story. They refused to accept any denials of wrongdoing and shaped his story as best they could into a confession that implicated Stephen in this brutal rape, bloody murder of stabbing of the stomach and slitting of the throat and ultimately shooting and mutilating her body, you know, the corpse and burning it, and all of which, there's this brutal rape murder supposedly happened in Stephen Avery's little trailer home where he was living back in the bedroom of that home, and there wasn't a single shred of evidence to support the story that they got out of Brendan Dassey. There was no blood. There was
no
DNA. Nothing.
I'm going to ask a couple questions.
Sure.
First of all, was this interrogation recorded? And secondly, why was a confession like this even allowed to be taken of a young man who A, was a juvenile, and B, had learning disabilities, let alone be admitted in a court of law?
Yes, it was recorded, and that's one of the ironies of timing here. Until about 6 months before the interrogation, it would not have been recorded, but the Wisconsin changed its law to mandate that any interrogation while under arrest had to be recorded, and this was videotaped. Only about half the states in America, even now, by the way, require any kind of electronic recording of custodial, that is, under arrest interrogations of suspects. Why were they allowed to do this without a parent or an attorney present? Because that is the law. The minimum requirements under the Constitution don't allow that. They don't require that a guardian or parent or lawyer be present if the suspect waives his rights or her rights under the Miranda warnings. Unfortunately, people, they've done studies now, and, often, teenagers, 15, 16 years old, really don't have the mental comprehension of what all Miranda rights mean. You hear them on TV, you have the right to remain silent, etc. But people, typically waive those rights thinking, well, if I'm innocent, I got nothing to hide.
Sure.
What they don't realize is they're opening themselves up to interrogation techniques that they are not equipped to handle. Now,
if
that does not have to be the law, by the way. Go ahead.
Sure. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to criminal defense lawyer Jerome F. Buting talk about his recently published book by HarperCollins titled Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. Mr. Buting practices law in Wisconsin with his wife, another superb criminal defense lawyer named Kathleen Skilling. And Jerry, if our listeners want to learn more about you and your law practice, do you have a website they can go to?
Yeah, they can go to buting.com, buting.com. And there's links from various parts of that website. What I started to say, and one of the things I think that can be changed in this system to make it more fair is, it does not have to be the law that police should be allowed to interrogate juveniles without a lawyer or guardian present. That's just the minimum constitutional requirement that's been set. Since this came out, Illinois has changed the law now. Anybody 15 and under cannot be interrogated without a lawyer present, and it cannot be waived. As I mentioned, Seattle has also changed their rules to prohibit the kind of interrogation of juveniles that you see here. So there are things that if people demand better, we can get better, and it's up to the states individually to make those changes.
Well, speaking of making the system better, we are taping this interview on May 24th. And approximately 6 weeks ago, it was announced by new Attorney General Jeff Sessions that he was disbanding the National Commission on Forensic Sciences. In light of the presence or lack thereof of DNA in the Stephen Avery case and other cases you have litigated, what do you think about that decision?
Well, I'm very disappointed in the decision, and I think that it's really rolling back the clock. The National Academy of Science in 2009 did the first really thorough study of the various fields of so-called forensic science that we use in the courtroom, and what they found was really shocking, that many of them were not validated. They've never been really proven scientifically, and since then, there have been very few changes, but one of those particular techniques is it's a microscopic hair comparison where you take a double-field microscope and you look at a hair from the crime scene, you pluck a hair from the defendant, and you look at them and say, you have an analyst saying, well, I think that this is similar to or consistent with the crime scene one. And that evidence has been used for years, decades, convicting people. And the FBI, finally, 2 years ago, did their own study of their own cases, about 268 of them, and found that in 95% of the time, their own analysts had misled or falsified the testimony, misleading the jury about the strength of that kind of comparison test. And in fact, since DNA has now come to be used more often, we're finding that when you then apply DNA tests to those two hairs, hairs that they claimed were consistent with or similar visually with the subjective opinion of an analyst, proved not to be linked at all. And I talk about one example of that in my book, in the this Ralph Armstrong case, another murder prosecution conviction, wrongful conviction in Wisconsin, where ultimately the gentleman was released after 29 years of wrongful conviction, and they used that kind of evidence against him at his trial, and then later DNA proved it was false. So, you know, rather than go backwards and disband a National Forensic Science Commission that was moving forward and was about to promulgate some standards that would apply to improve the science that's used in our courtrooms, Attorney General Sessions disbanded it. And, you know, really with the encouragement, sadly, of the Prosecutors Association, because they don't like, this is another one of the pet peeves I have, they don't like the idea that forensic or crime labs should be independent of them. Virtually every crime lab in the country is organized under the Justice Department or Police Department. They're not independent of law enforcement. They don't do blind testing of samples. They know what they're testing when they test it, and they know, therefore, you know, what result the law enforcement would like them to come up with. And now every week, all you got to do is pick up the paper or go online. Every week there seems to be another scandal with crime labs all over this country, either, you know, corrupt or incompetent analysts who've been falsifying evidence, or, you know, incompetent science that's used in the lab. And in Massachusetts, just in the last month, something like 22,000 cases, convictions, had to be overturned and dismissed because of a particular analyst who was falsifying her results for many, many, many years without anybody catching it.
Yeah. Well, we certainly expect more of our criminal justice system. Unfortunately, that will have to be the last word. Thank you so much for joining us here on Author Chats. We've been talking to criminal defense lawyer Jerome F. Buting about his recently published book, Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. This is a very important book for everyone who cares about America's criminal justice system. Thanks again, Jerry, and thank you to all of my listeners. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. Have a good day.